Good evening and welcome to Studies Through the Bible with Pastor Zach Ebarb. I am Pastor Zach, and tonight we are getting into a very interesting question that surprisingly enough tend to get a little bit more often than when I first started preaching would have ever thought that I got, which is the question of what is idolatry and does it still exist today? You know, oftentimes when pastors or preachers, missionaries, whatever, whenever we're going through the Bible, we kind of have a differentiation on examples and things that we discuss depending on what book of the Bible that we are in. And even not just specifically books of the Bible, but even variations amongst whether or not it's the Old Testament or the New Testament, when we are looking at biblical passages and preparing sermons, lessons, these kinds of things. And it's very interesting that most of the time, if you listen to a pastor and they're talking about a New Testament theology, doctrine, whatever, all too often, the word idolatry really never comes into mind. It doesn't get brought into the conversation. And then with the Old Testament, that's something that's constantly brought into the equation over and over and over and over and over again. And what makes that interesting is that in the Old and New Testament alike, idolatry is talked about very, very heavily, meaning that it plays a very significant role in the bad decisions, the sins, the possibilities for God's people to fall into, and that it plays a very heavy role. So, to kind of begin to understand what that means, we have to identify what is idolatry, right? We have to understand that particular word to really get engaged with this question on a deeper level. Most of the time when you think of idolatry, you probably think of things that have a lot to do with the root word of that word, which is idol. And when you think of idols, I'd be, willing to bet that when you think about an idol, you tend to think about, oh, you know, maybe ancient Greece, ancient Rome, ancient Egypt, really any world history class that you probably ever took in high school, going back into those ancient civilizations of Persia and Babylon and Assyria and Rome and Greece and India, China, you know, these very, very powerful ancient empires that you would have looked at and studied thoroughly throughout your grade school years. And you probably go back to those cultures and you think about things like Zeus, Mars, Hermes. Goodness, it's been forever since I looked at the Persians and theirs. You might go back to Egypt and look at Pluto and you know, these kinds of individuals that existed, Ra, the sun god of Egypt, because Pluto is Rome, Zach. You go back and look at these particular gods, these mythological gods, that there's lots of stories that are centered around them. You have lots of statues and artwork and these kinds of things. That's probably more where your brain tends to go when you think about idolatry. And that's not an unfair place for your brain to go, because a lot of the idolatry that is discussed in the Old Testament have to do with very much similar things to that, right? You have Baal or Baal. That's probably how some of you pronounce it. I've heard both. I don't really care if you've listened to this show long enough. If you pronounce it well enough, I know what you're talking about. I don't care about how you pronunciate it. That's most of the time subjective, depending on who you're talking to. And you have Ashtaroth, you have Molech, you have all of these very, very strange gods that all have origin stories. They all have mythological stories. They have statues built out of them. There's different things that they're in charge of, that they, you know, that they're overlooking. And so, you know, when you start thinking about those kinds of cultures, it's definitely not a an incorrect place for your mind to go. But it is a place that our mind goes because we have been incorrectly taught what that term means. And we've been incorrectly taught, not on purpose, by the way. You know, I'm not trying to say that there's any pastors or missionaries that were like, well, we're going to teach them that idolatry is little funny statues and mythology and guys that do weird things. I'm not trying to make that kind of a point. What I'm saying is that that's the only kind of idolatry that most of the time gets discussed in God's houses, you know, God's churches, unless we're talking, you know, unless we're trying to make some flippant ball point about the ball field or, you know, skipping church for the deer stand, this kind of thing. And so when we're looking at this word idolatry, what you need to understand is that idolatry does not present itself the same way in every situation, but it does have one particular core value. And that core value is this: to be idolatrous, to be worshiping an idol, to be committing idolatry, means that we give reverence or attention to something in place of God. That's about the best way that we could define what exactly that means. I read some different definitions last week as I was looking over this, because we didn't do one last week because I forgot. Oh, goodness, excuse me. That we had Labor Day on Monday last week. And I got informed that we had Labor Day Sunday afternoon as I was getting ready for this particular podcast. So we didn't do one last Monday, but as I was going about looking, there's all kinds of different definitions that I found. There were some that said, you know, like Webster's Dictionary, which is a good place to always start, is the worship of idols or excessive devotion to or reverence for some person or thing, which is kind of good, but it's also kind of not a good definition simply because it's a subjective definition. You know, you could make an argument from the place of how this is being defined by Webster's Dictionary that us worshiping God is idolatrous to other people. You see what I'm saying? And so when we're talking about this definition of idolatry, and we're really trying to mold that over, we don't want to just boil that word down to merely meaning Webster's definition of, well, to give excessive reverence to something or someone. That's a very subjective definition that allows us to make an argument for why practically every religion, every hobby, every anything you do could be constituted as idolatry. So when we're talking about how God and the Bible define it, we want to stay within the parameters of idolatry is giving attention, worship, reverence to something or someone outside of God. Meaning that if you are reverencing, worshiping, giving time to something else, anything else besides God, then you are indeed committing idolatry. And that could be that, you know, you spend an excessive amount of time looking at your table. I mean, it could be anything that you want to worship. You have the capabilities of making anything into an idol. And so let's talk about how that is then, okay? Well, how then do we get into this position where we bring about idolatry into our lives? And this, because this is a very hard concept for us. It's a very hard concept to navigate because we don't understand how it is that giving attention or giving reverence to something other than God constitutes idolatry. And the best way to explain it for you in a modern time is essentially probably something you've heard out of a pulpit many, many times in your life, which is, you know, if you pick anything over coming to the house of God to worship, that's an idol in your life. Let's take that down and break that down for a moment, because you go, well, no, I don't, you know, I don't go out in the front yard and bow to the baseball field and offer up incense and make prayers to and concessionals to the ball field. But let's think about what it means when a pastor or a preacher says that. What's really being brought on here? Well, remember, the definition of idolatry is to give reverence or attention to something over God. That's the definition. Meaning that if God has appointed a command, you know, oh, we're supposed to gather together at the beginning of the week for the worship and the praise of God. If we choose to do anything over that, we have made that an idol. Even if you don't believe it's a God, even if you don't believe that it has power or authority, even if you don't believe that if you go out on the ball field and sacrifice a goat, you're going to get something out of it. Even if you don't believe any of those things, and even if you're not viewing them in that way, you are implicitly making them that because you are choosing them over the genuine thing. You are choosing to go and do something that is not worth or valuable to your time over something that is worth and valuable to your time. You are giving your attention, your resources, your energy, your strength to an activity in place of the one that God has asked you to be a part of. This is no different than getting in trouble with your parents at home. If your parents probably spent a lot of your childhood telling you, well, you need to learn to prioritize your time, right? Really good example. You know, you're 13, 14, I don't know. I didn't do this as much in high school. I had other things to do. But 13, 14 years old, and you got a friend and they're going to have a birthday party on Friday. Okay. So you come home on Monday because your friends invited you on Monday. And most of the time, if your friends were as irresponsible as many of mine were in high school, you probably didn't even know about the party until like Wednesday or Thursday. And you were supposed to be there Friday. Right. But so you come in on Monday, let's say for the sake of the example that you had a responsible friend, which I highly doubt. And so you come in Monday and you say, Mother, Father, dear, I would really like to be able to go to my such and such friend's birthday party. And your mother and father, I am sure, said something to this effect. If you have your schoolwork and your chores done, then you may go. Okay? If your parents didn't tell you that and they just let you go, that's great for you, for the rest of you, and even for those of you that cannot identify with this illustration, I wish that you could, because this is a very valuable lesson that all parents are supposed to teach their children of the value of prioritizing using your time wisely. Okay? Well, you know, you go, okay, I'll do it. Because that's what every teenager says at 13, 14 years old. Tuesday comes. You're asking your parents about the party, reminding them about the party more than likely, because kids like to do this to their parents. Your parents say, yeah, I know about it, but you have not yet completed the necessary tasks to be able to go and participate in this event. And you go, well, you know, I got all week. Right? I got all week. It's Friday. That's when the party is. Today's Tuesday. Not a big deal. I got all week. Well, Wednesday gets here. Now, Wednesday, hopefully, your parents were taking you to church. And so you come home Wednesday, and then you decide, well, I'm going to pick all this stuff up. And your parents say, nope, come on, it's time to go to church. And then you get mad about it, right? Well, I don't even need to go there, dot, 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 dot. And your parents tell you again, You have plenty of time left, but you need to learn to use your time wisely, because when it's God's day, this is where we go to God's house. Okay? So you fuss, scream, kick, holler. You go to church, though. Thursday comes around. You find out on Thursday that there's going to be a fun little get-together after school, some sort of nonsense of that nature. And you really, really want to go to that. Because this happened all the time when I was in high school. And you ask your parents and they say, sure, go ahead and go. But, you know, remember, if you're wanting to go to that birthday party on Friday, you better have all your things done. You better have everything done that you need to have done. And long story short, of course, you're out late on Thursday. You get home. You, oh, I don't want to do it. I'll do it later. Friday comes. You've not completed the task. You don't get to go. Well, you're angry about that, right? That's immediately your reaction. I'm angry about that. And you go to your parents and you tell them, I'm angry about that. You know, it's not that big of an ordeal. It's not that big of a thing. And they say, well, yes, it is, because we're your parents and we told you to have this done before you could go and experience this other part of life. It's much the same of what God asks us from time to time. You can do whatever you want during the week. God will, you know, God's not going to stop you from going to the ballpark. God's not going to stop you from fishing. God's not going to stop you from hunting. But you do it on your time. It means you prioritize your life during the week to where if you want to participate in those kinds of things, you can do so. But when you take away from God's time, things that God has commanded you to do, you are then placing those activities, those objects, that entertainment, that person, that family event, whatever it is, as equal to God the Father, because you're using God's time to participate in this event. And that's what we need to understand about idolatry. Idolatry definitely still exists. It just does not exist as frequently as it used to, because that's one of the other interesting things, is that actual ancient idolatry does indeed still exist. If you spend any time around Hindu culture, Hindu culture is very, very heavily idol laden. If you spend any time around Chinese culture is very heavily idol laden. If you go and look at the Mongol culture, if you look at even some of the Egyptian culture, if you look at Buddhism, there's a lot of ancient idolatry that does in fact still exist in many way forms or fashions. And in fact, this might get me in a lot of trouble, but I'm going to say it anyway. Even if you go and look at Catholicism does indeed practice a lot of ancient idolatry, whether they want to admit that or not, because the argumentation there is, well, it's a statue of Mary, it's a statue of Christ, even though we're not supposed to make any graven images of Christ. It's a statue of Saint so-and-so. It's a statue of an angel or whatever. That's still, at the end of the day, a form of idolatry, whether you like it or not, because you're worshiping those things in place of, you're giving reverence to those things in place of God. And to try to say, well, I give less reverence to Mary than I do to God, that's going to be an interesting conversation, because reverence doesn't have a upper reaching limit. Like, there's not multiple levels of reverence. Reverence is reverence. There's no, well, I give a little reverence here and some big reverence here. It doesn't work that way. You're either reverencing or you're not. And so idolatry does still exist in many, many different forms, in many, many different places, and in many, many, many lives of even God's people. So that answers the question of what is idolatry? Okay, you know, that answers what does that mean? And that means that if we give reverence, attention to, time to, worship to, whatever word you want to fill in there, anything outside of God, that's what constitutes the idea of idolatry. When we get to the part of does it still exist? Well, yeah, it does still exist in many forms or fashions. We've named off a few cultures already that still practice what we would refer to as ancient idolatry. And we even talked about some of the modern touches that idolatry has, even today, that whether we understand it as being that or not is irrelevant. You know, if we're, like I said, if we're putting anything in place of God in our day-to-day lives, we have implicitly, whether we realize it or not, made an idol out of that thing. You know, a really great example of a modern form of this is there was it's a country song of sorts. Every now and again, I turn the radio over to that genre because I was raised up on it. But it's a modern, more modern song. What I remember about it is that it's called Praying in a Deer Stand. And in the lyrics of the song, the writer is talking about how his church is the woods, that I kind of got a chuckle out of it because, well, what's he talking about? Well, he's talking about an idolatrous affair in the woods. Like, I don't need to be in church with a church family worshiping God on Sunday. I can do my praying in a deer stand because a deer stand is my form of church. I mean, that's a very, very revealing song. I mean, it whether he realized what he was doing or not in the song, he's stating the fact that he has an idolatrous relationship with this activity, that this activity will indeed take precedence over God. And the way that he justifies it is by saying that, well, I'm reverencing God by not reverencing God. That's literally what we're saying in the song. And that's a very, very fantastic, in my opinion, modern version of idolatry. Now, what a lot of people never ask me about this aspect of things, you know, I get a lot of, well, what is idolatry? And then, you know, why do Christians care about it? You know, like, how does it even still exist? Why do people talk about it? The question that I never get is, why is it bad? Why is it that idolatry is something that is so important for us to watch and pay attention to that it is discussed in both the Old and the New Testament? And I know probably what you're thinking as well. I mean, the New Testament was still written in the days of ancient Rome, ancient Greece. You know, there was a lot of these gods that still existed. If you look at Paul in Athens over there, he's walking through Athens. He's talking to people in the streets about Jesus Christ, and he's asking them questions about their culture and about their religions. And then when he gets to the Areopagus, he actually uses this, doesn't he? Because he gets to the Areopagus and they say, you know, we want to hear what this crazy guy has to say about this weird god he's talking about. And he says, I perceive, ye men of Athens, that you are very religious. Because as I walked through your streets, I even found a idol to the unknown god. That's what it's labeled as. Well, even though that does occur in an ancient time, we've already pointed out that there are still a many, many, many modern versions of idolatry. They just don't present themselves as statues and religions. Most of the time, they are presented as activities and entertainment, technology, things that you like, hobbies, those kinds of ordeals. Those tend to be where we put the idolatry into place because we no longer have an idolatry of serving man-made gods. We've instead turned this idolatry that we follow in today's time of an idolatry of the self. So how is it that this is dangerous? How is it that this is bad? How is it that this could go terribly, 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 terribly wrong? Well, first of all, if we are practicing an idolatry of the self, then that means that the only person that matters in our day-to-day life is ourselves. There are countless times in the Bible that only being worried about or caring about yourself in any form or fashion goes horribly wrong. Horribly wrong. A perfect example of this from a saved person point of view, right? I mean, we can pull out endless examples of this going wrong and the lives of lost people or people who pit themselves against God in the Bible. But a very good example of someone who is quote unquote saved is Jacob and Esau. You have Jacob, who is supposed to be the one who's going to receive the birthright from God. Okay? God comes to Isaac, their father, says, you know, you're going to have two children, and the older will serve the younger. And Isaac didn't really want to accept that. He liked the older son. He liked Esau. Esau was a rugged guy. He was a hunter, and he was a fighter and a scrapper. He was, you know, essentially your man's man kind of idea, okay? And then you had Jacob, who was basically a sissy mommy's boy. That's who Jacob was. And Isaac said, nah, you know, God, I mean, I know what you said about Jacob's going to get the birthright, but, you know, really, at the end of the day, probably not going to do that. Because he liked Esau, and Jacob was a mama's boy. And there comes a day that Esau comes in from the field. He's been out hunting. He hadn't had very much success. Things not gone so well for him. And he's kind of a sissy in his own right in some ways as well. And he's at the dinner table, and he sees that Jacob is cooking soup, and he says, hey, why don't you let me have some of that? And Jacob, only caring about himself, by the way, only worried about himself, not trusting in God, not reverencing God, not giving God the faith that God will deal with this situation in the way that God wants it dealt with. Only thinking about himself, worshiping himself. Says, well, I tell you what, Esau, I'll give you a bowl if you sell me the birthright. Well, Esau's a little dramatic, and, you know, I'm going to starve to death, and all this little bit of a drama, melodrama plays out. And then Esau says, okay, fine, yeah, I'll sell it to you for a bowl of stew, which is a very, very dumb deal. To give up the inheritance of your entire family for a bowl of soup is not wise. But even there, who is Esau serving? Who is Esau reverencing? He's reverencing himself. He doesn't view the gift of the inheritance of the elder son with any value, and he doesn't even view it with the spiritual and biblical value that God places very heavily on that particular birthright. It's that birthright that guaranteed who was the promised land's people. I mean, that's who guaranteed who God's people are. When Israel traces their lineage, they don't go, oh, well, you know, I'm going to go back to Abraham's father, Terah. You're not going to go back to that. Because Terah didn't have the birthright. He didn't have the covenant. He didn't have the gift. He didn't have the promise. They don't care even a little bit about Terah. They care a lot about Abraham. And they're glad that they're a child of Abraham because Abraham received the birthright. So Esau and Jacob are both in that story, serving themselves, their own self-interest. The one of them completely tosses any faith in God to the side, decides he's going to be a trickster and a liar and a deceiver to get what he wants out of life. And the other one has no value whatsoever in things that are invaluable. And by throwing that away, he's literally throwing away his life for a bowl of soup. Well, I think you can see now how that would be a very bad thing to do and how idolatry could be very destructive in the lives of people. Because, see, idolatry is very, very good at masking itself as an excuse, as masking itself as an activity, as masking itself as a part-time escapade, as a one-time thing, as a no-big-deal kind of thing that ends up becoming a regular part of your life. For Esau, his behavior never really changes. He continues to serve himself, serve himself, serve himself, and he makes excuses and makes excuses and makes excuses. And Jacob doesn't become the great man of God that he's supposed to be until he throws that idolatry to the side of worshiping his own self. He doesn't become Israel until God finally gets him in a place physically and spiritually where he is relying on God as opposed to relying on himself. That's what makes idolatry so dangerous, is that you and I practice it all the time and we don't even realize we're doing it 99% of the time. Anytime you're relying on your own strengths, you're reverencing your own talents, your own abilities, your financial success, your job, your wife, your kids, anytime you're reverencing something above God, you're giving undue time and attention to something that belongs to God, you are doing this. And many times you are able to try and excuse it even as being something of God. You know, as a pastor, one of the saddest things that I deal with on a regular basis is you'll see somebody that's supposed to be at church, they're not at church. And you'll go, huh, well, that's really odd for so-and-so to not be here. And I have a much older congregation where I pastor. And so most of the time, if I don't see somebody who's usually there, something bad has happened. I mean, that's usually how it goes. There's been a fall, there's been some trouble or some health struggles, or somebody maybe, God forbid, has passed away. And so you'll give them a call. And, oh no, you know, everything's fine. The grandkids were over. And so we didn't come to church because we had the grandkids over at the house. That, as a pastor, of course, you kind of go, okay. You know, you kind of are expected to kind of play that off. But in the back of your mind, you're going, okay. And so why did that miss? Well, we didn't want to miss time with our grandkids. And you go, well, what better time is there to spend with your grandkids than in the house of God? And here's the sad part about it is, in this example, you may already be doing this, by the way, of going, well, I mean, the Bible says you're supposed to spend time with your family and you're supposed to take care of your family and make sure that you develop those relationships. To which my answer to you is, what better place to develop those relationships than in God's house? What better place to guarantee a long and an eternal and everlasting relationship with those grandkids than in God's house? What better place to make sure that your grandkids are going to grow up into people who continue to care about you than to take them to God's house? Because this is oftentimes what I see, is that I see grandkids or grandparents who spend time and hours on Sundays with their grandkids. And the whole time they try to biblically justify it. And not because I question them, by the way. I am not the kind of pastor. I do not go chase you down. I do not quiz you. I do not hold you accountable. That's God's job, not mine. Then they'll run, and I'll preach, and I'll say, this is a bad idea. You know, you put God first, and everything else falls in line. Meaning that don't worship any idols, whether that's family, activities, boating, fishing, hunting, whatever. You do what you're supposed to do for God. You follow what God's told you to do, and you will be amazed at how much God will bless and take care of all those other things that you are prioritizing first. Now, spend all this time skipping church, spending time with family, spending time with the grandkids, this kind of stuff. And then those grandkids hit about 18, 19, 20 years old. And their kids, who they've done this same thing with, by the way, that if there's a vacation, there's a trip, there's a ball game, they've skipped church because little junior's got to be at the ball game. And they'll do these things. Now they're hitting 70, 80, 90 years old. Their kids are 60 and 50 and 40. And their grandkids are 20 and 30, and even as young as teenagers sometimes, depending on how the family lays out. And now grandma and grandpa, who have prioritized everything but God and God's house in the lives of their children and in the lives of their grandchildren, are now starting to hit an age where they need their children and their grandchildren to step up, take care of them, watch over them, take them to church, help get them taken care of at home, help them with groceries, help them with all these things that happen as you get older. And because they've not instilled any actual values, any actual morality into their children and into their grandchildren, because remember, God was on the back burner for anything else that little Junior and little Junior the second wanted to do. Then they find themselves alone. And they just don't understand it. I see this all the time in nursing homes. I see this all the time in hospitals. You know, I just don't get it. I did this and I did this and I did this. And in the back of your mind, you're going, well, yeah, you did do all that. You did everything, but the things that mattered. That's what idolatry will do. Idolatry in your life is very well hidden. It's very, very dangerous. It is something that will destroy God's churches. It destroys the relationships amongst God's people. And it destroys God's people's families. And sometimes it does it so well, they don't even know why it is they are in the boat they're in. In fact, they will still continue to preach and teach the same ideology that has led to where they are in their life, because they don't realize what's going on. The reason that the Old Testament and the New Testament constantly say, watch out for idolatry, watch out for idolatry, watch out for idolatry, is not because you as a believer are going to walk out on the street and some Buddhist is going to talk to you and you're going to go, oh my goodness, I've missed out on Siddhartha Gautama's call to action. I've missed out on being a Buddhist for all these years. I've never gotten that story. And for those who might have that story, I would argue you probably weren't a believer in God to begin with. Because if you go and look at the teachings of Siddhartha Gautama, I mean, he didn't even believe that he was a god. You'd be a fool to worship a man who's telling you, I'm not God and I can't do anything for you. This is just my opinion of how you should live your life. That's a really dumb thing to do. I haven't heard a lot of that. But I have heard a lot of idolatry where, well, we hit the deer stand all fall long. Well, we went to the ball field all spring and fall long. Well, during the summertime, you know, we got vacations here and vacations there and things to do here. And our kids are drowning in these activities and these activities and these activities. And we just do not have time for God this month. You know, maybe next year we'll get back with you on God. And that is what is single-handedly, that idolatry is what is single-handedly destroying God's people on a regular basis. Because the danger of idolatry is always that, in this day and time, you will end up worshiping yourself. And when you end up worshiping yourself, you are bound to see your life destroyed. Because nothing good comes out of worshiping yourself. If you go through the Bible and you look at the lives of all of the men in the Bible, we're actually doing this with our youth group right now. It's Ordinary People, Extraordinary God. As we're going through every single person that we talk about in the Bible with the kids, it's just three very simple little things. It's who are they? What was their best moment in life? What was their worst? And it took those kids, and they're from like 3 to 12. Like, we're not talking about teenagers. We're talking about young kids. It took them about 3 people to realize that the best moments, the best times in these people's lives is when they were not focused on themselves. They were focused on God. And the worst times, the times where everything went horribly and awfully wrong, were when they were worried about only themselves. Whether that's Moses or Aaron or Abram or Abraham, as he becomes later known, or Adam and Eve. In fact, there's only one person in the entire Bible that we do not see at some point or another fall to idolatry, and that's Jesus Christ. And Jesus Christ, who comes in the form of a man, and yet he's all God at the same time, his life was lived only for other people. And I know what you might be thinking is, well, I mean, yeah, that's nice there, Mr. Zach, but Lord have mercy, the life of Jesus Christ, I mean, poverty, walking everywhere that you go, always looking for the next meal, you know, eating out of the edges of the fields at the good graces of other people. A guy who was literally murdered in the worst way possible by humanity, well, attempted murder anyway, gave up his life for us. You know, you're talking about a life there, Mr. Zach, that does not sound very appealing to me. In fact, I think I might take the other road. I think I might take my chances with worrying about number one only, because that route is a horrible route. Well, it is a horrible route if you stop at the death of Jesus Christ. It's not a horrible route when you get to the resurrection of Jesus Christ, where you get to the authority of Jesus Christ, where you get to Jesus Christ becoming your high priest, where we get to Jesus Christ saving the sins of the entire world through sacrifice and suffering and caring about somebody other than himself. It's really not bad when you get to the fact that now Christ has become the king of the world and that he's going to return again to help free us the rest of the way, to help redeem us the rest of the way, to deal with the evil and the sin and the horrid wretchedness of this world. When you start getting into the rest of the details of what that accomplished, oh, the life of Jesus Christ was one that was spectacular. And it was spectacular because it was spent serving other people. It was spent reverencing God. It is a life that was lived truly to the fullest, and a life that was greatly rewarded for that living. And I promise you, your life will be the same way. Yeah, you can do things for yourself. You're never going to feel as good about doing things for yourself as worshiping yourself, idolizing yourself, as you do when you reach out and do something for someone else. You will never feel as fulfilled, as loved, as rewarded doing things for yourself as you will for when you do things for your family, for your friends, for your neighbors, for your community, for your God. Because see, when you're out doing things for other people, you're reverencing God. You're not looking at yourself. You're not practicing the idolatry of the self. Because I'd be pretty good guess that basically any of you that are on here tonight, you don't have a statue you lay out in front of every day before you go to bed. But I'm sure that you do lay out before yourself on a regular basis. And so, what is idolatry? Idolatry is anything that you and I put before the things of God. Whether that's the time of God, the worship of God, the obedience of God, the studying of God's word, the communication with God through prayer that we're supposed to have. It's any time we put something in a higher position than God or the things that God has asked us to do. Because the moment we replace those things that God has asked us to do with something else, we are implicitly saying, this is worthier of my time than this is, or than you are God. Secondly, does it still exist? Oh, yes. In fact, it's thriving. It's doing better now than it's ever done before, because it has convinced everybody that it is dead and gone and does not exist. And as long as you don't have a little statue in your house, you're good. It is very much alive, and it is alive in God's people and in lost people alike. And why is that bad? That's bad because it will destroy your life. The more that you put into the place of the things of God, the things of man, you are sure to fail. And you are sure to fail in a very, very, very big way. Sometimes in ways that your life will never fully recover from. You'll be forgiven for it. But you will definitely find yourself in a different state of being than if you had never done it before. And so that is the answer to what is idolatry? Does it still exist? And then the part that I tack on that nobody ever asked, which is, why is it bad? Why is it dangerous? I hope that all of you have enjoyed this new style so far. As I've said, I'm going to kind of remind everybody again really quick, because our questions coming in have slowed down a little bit. Y'all can't be doing that to me if we're going to keep doing this the way that we're supposed to be doing it. We've changed the format of the show. We've gone from looking at individual books of the Bible and breaking down chapter by chapter and verse by verse, and we've quit doing that, number one, because of time constraints. We sat down and mapped it out, and I mean, it would literally take me a lifetime to maybe get close to doing the entire Bible for you guys in that form or fashion of a study. But the second reason is because the goal of all of this is to get you to study more, to get you to study more in depth, to get you involved in God's Word in a way that's actually going to bring about a desire in you to want to read and to study the Word of God more. And so we started kind of talking to people and realized that a lot of the hang up for studying the Bible has a lot more to do with some questions that need to be answered that you don't know how to find the answer to, or maybe some questions that you think you know what the answer is, but you're not satisfied with it, these kinds of things. And that basically, when you guys hit one of those questions, you come to one of those moments, you just go, well, okay, either I'm dumb, or you know what, this is, I can't understand this if I wanted to, or you become bored with it or frustrated with it, so you just chunk the Bible to the side and you go on about your day. And so what we decided to do is we put together a very, very large list of commonly asked questions that I've gotten in my time as a pastor and time talking to people and knocking on doors and inviting people to church, these kinds of things, as well as questions that have come from saved people, because obviously I want to entice the lost to read the Bible, but the saved should know the Bible. And so we don't want you getting knocked off the road in any way, shape, or form by not knowing the answers to those questions. So as always, if you guys leave a comment on the little show thing here or on the Facebook thing that's connected to the church, they all know about that. I do not. If you go and leave a comment, though, on any of the things connected to the show, we'll send you an email address, send you questions. I'll answer your questions personally, individually, but then we add them to the list of the questions that we're going through for the podcast. I believe that this is question 11 tonight. I might be wrong about that. It's question 10, question 11, somewhere around there. And so make sure to be sending those questions in, because right now we're kind of doing broad overview type questions, such as tonight, like what is idolatry? That's a very broad overview question. But I know that here shortly, we're going to be starting to get into more specific doctrinal-based questions that I can give kind of my opinions on what I think might be questions that you're struggling with in that realm. But I often find that the more specific the questions get, the less I'm actually going to be able to pinpoint what that question's going to be. And I've learned that very well, and we've started at our church having a Q&A service one Sunday night a month where everybody just asks questions about the Bible that they've had from their month of reading. And I get questions all the time down there that never in my life have I ever gotten that require me to sit on my haunches and think for a moment and consider what it is that I'm being asked. So make sure to send those in, because I know that if my congregation has it, all of you have these kinds of questions as well. And we'd love to answer those to help you keep studying the Bible, but also because there truly is going to be somebody else who has the same question that you have. So make sure to put those out there. I want to answer as many as we can. Like I said, well, I'll take the time to answer it for you, and then we'll talk about it here for everybody else. But I hope that all of you have enjoyed this, that you've learned a little something from it, that you found out that idolatry is not nearly as dead as maybe you thought it was, and it's given you some things to consider and think about in your day-to-day life as you're going from place to place. With all of that said, I hope all of you have a blessed week. We pray for everybody that's on here. We don't know your actual name, but we know your username.